told it on himself. See, Debye with Huckel worked out Debye-Huckel theory of electrolytes, and this is fine with regard to activities and so on, laying the groundwork for a lot of development there. But it was an error when it came to electrical conductivity. There was a deficiency there. And Ansager evidently recognized this deficiency. So one day, a young, tall blonde shows up at Debye's office in, I guess it was Zurich, I don't know, it was somewhere in Switzerland. He was a professor at one of the universities in Switzerland. This blonde Norwegian comes and looks in the door and says, "You, Professor Debye?" "Yes." "Your theory's wrong." Debye says, "Well," I called him in and says, "Be seated, tell me, what's wrong?" So then he started talking about the electrical conductivity part of it. You know, Ansager was right. And Debye told this story. I heard him say that. So I think he had a perfect right to say, "See here, Lars." It wasn't the case of... I recall that because it was not a case of being arrogant. Mm-hmm. He was just treating a person on, you might say, equal terms, so to speak. But he would be gentle with anybody else. It's a he had a very... He wrote an article once for Scientific American. And he asked me for some information and thoughts that he might convey in it about molecular, macromolecular dimensional distributions. And so I said it to him and went on. Some months later, I got a letter from him. I had kind of forgotten about it. I hadn't seen the article. He says, "The article appeared in Scientific American, but I have to apologize for it. They rewrote it, and they left out what I thought was important. They left out what I considered best. They left out some of the stuff you gave me to write, and I hope you'll understand the reason for it." And he wrote, he took the trouble of telling me that. I have that letter here in my file. I didn't, I had forgotten about that particular thing, but when I went through, oh, I also remember, Debye was one of the first people on the Welsh Foundation Scientific Board when it had just started.
Yes.
And they were looking for a scientific director, the job that Milligan. Debye asked me, said they were looking for a director. He asked me if I was interested in it. And this was at a time when our rapport was very good indeed. Well, it was never bad, but we had gotten to know each other. And I subsequently declined, regretfully declined, said that I wanted to stay at Illinois closer to academic work and research rather than get involved in the foundation job. And I believe, though I never got a formal offer, you understand, I believe that his recommendation would have carried the day, because he was the man who was calling the shots. Mm-hmm. Until then, they got Milligan to take the job, and he stayed there a long, long time.
Yes.
Then,
oh.
Then what's his name? Oh, you know, the former president of Rice, Heckerman, is now director. So I thought about that. It would have been a sinecure, but in the state of Texas, but I don't know. I think about it in retrospect. I think I made the right decision at the time. All I know is that when I made decisions to go away, like to the ACS and so on, it was a terrible mistake, and it was, maybe I should have weathered the storm at Illinois. Nonetheless, well, I don't mean to say that my life was unhappy here. Quite the contrary. Why did we move back here? I mean, we do like the environment. We have friends at the university, although they're diminishing. One of our best friends, oh, Harold Urey. Oh, I could tell you anecdotes about
Yeah.
Urey.
Yes. But get back to, well, I was offered another foundation job. The Welch, not the Welch one I mentioned, but Sloan Foundation. They wanted me to head up the scientific part of that. That was when I had my heyday as dean. Geez, you know, you get at a time when I wasn't thinking about anything else, didn't want anything else. It was when I wanted something else that these things didn't come, see. Rather than go to Santa Barbara, I might well have gone to Sloan. I don't know, you see. Maybe even Welch, who the hell knows? I don't know. But, you know, the timeliness, there was a period when, you know, everything was running for you. And then you get in out of it, and you're out of it just as much as a political figure gets out of it. Now, I think I interjected a comment earlier about political methods getting into the academy. I did not myself conduct a campaign, but I unwittingly did. I use the word unwittingly because here's what happened. Work was going well. Research was going well at Illinois. And I had heard that I'd been nominated, you know, that sort of thing, and, you know, it's hard to get in and all that sort of stuff, and of course I wanted it, loved it, the idea, who would say to the contrary. But I wasn't getting around talking to people. I wasn't giving lectures. I did the work, but I was preoccupied with deaning and everything else, but that didn't keep me from not doing the work. But I never went to meetings anymore to give papers. I had cut that out. And then Herb Gutowski came to me one day and said, Fred, you know, you've done some interesting work here. You really ought to talk about this stuff. And I said, well, oh, where do I go? Nobody's asked me to talk anywhere. Well, I'll tell you, I think maybe they'll ask you. So, Herb Gutowski, arranged for me to give lectures at Princeton and Harvard and where else now on this Eastern sojourn. I'm trying to remember. There might have been one more. Maybe it was at Yale. I'm not certain, but I know Princeton and Harvard for sure. And it had to do with this calculation of reaction probabilities. And I remember going to Princeton, and at that time, Hugh Taylor was still dean of the graduate school there. He's a physical chemist, of course. And I remember his coming to the lecture, and he came to me beforehand. He said, I hope you'll forgive me if I have to leave a few minutes early, but I have such commitment, but I certainly wanted to come. So I'm very generous, you know, a colleague to colleague, you know, one dean to another. And I gave the lecture, and it seemed to go pretty well. And then I went to Harvard, and that lecture went very well, too. And I was delighted. I remember they played a little trick on me at Harvard, a little fun. When I was finished, I said, I believe that is the last slide, and I'm through. And I had talked about computer calculations. And the landing slide operator said, oh, no, there's one more. I said, one more? I didn't think there were any more. He says, what's the machine you use for the calculation? He put on a slide, and there was a picture of a cement mixer. And everybody laughed. We had a lot of fun. But that wasn't all. Then Herb, I think it was Herb, arranged for me to give lectures in Berkeley, UCLA, and Caltech. Same subject. He never said so, but I knew goddamn well what he had in mind. Those are the places where the academicians are. You gotta go talk to those guys. And the next year I was elected. Well, okay, look, I'm not sorry. Don't get me wrong.
I understand.
But you begin to ask, what goes on in this world? Do you have to run for things like that?
Yeah. No, I understand exactly what you're saying.
I can tell you a nice, an interesting thing that happened. Oh, I get more and more anecdotes. I'm taking up too much
time.
Do you mind?
No.
I can tell you I was going to tell you an anecdote about tell you about Libby. Willard Libby. It was at UCLA. I believe it was that night I gave that lecture, or maybe it was on another occasion, but I'm sure it was the same lecture. Maybe it wasn't on that same trip, but that's immaterial. Because my wife was with me at the time, and we went to the house of one of the members of the department, Bob Scott's house, actually, and Bill Libby was at the dinner, and there were a couple of other people there, and Bill was much preoccupied with making air raid shelters. He had was starting a series of newspaper articles on build your own shelter, do it yourself sort of job, protect yourself against radiation damage in case of a nuclear attack. And well, the dinner table conversation ultimately got to something like that, and he says, of course, if you can't build a shelter, as you really ought to, and I can tell you how to build a shelter, there are things you can do in your own house if you go to the right place. For example, let's go down to the basement here, and I'll show you where you should go if you had a situation. So we went down the basement. He said, now, if there were an attack at an e-named the Air Force base up north of Santa Barbara somewhere. They said, if there is an attack there, what you should do, get into this corner of the basement and wait a while. That'd be the best thing to do. The best, have your aerial shelter. And I'm writing a series of articles on it, he said. And you can do it and equip it for your labor plus about $25 to $30 worth of equipment that you have to buy. In other words, it's not going to be a big investment except sweat. And I said, geez, that sounds pretty good. How do you do it? Well, the best place, of course, is to have a hillside. You have a hillside, and you can dig a hole into the hill, and you can pile up some dirt, and you put some steel beams across, and then pile some dirt on top, and you can have a little transistor radio and some supplies in there, and if you're on the right side of the hill, you know, everything's fine. And I said, gee, that sounds pretty good, but tell me, Bill, if you're going to put steel beams across there, how are you going to do this for your $25 to $30? He says, well, I go over to the junkyard of the physical plant, and I can find these things at the university. I said, yeah, but look, you're writing a series of articles for people all over the country. They can't go to the university plant junkyard and pick up steel beams. Now, this is going to be a practical thing. Now, really, how are you going to do it? So he sort of stroked his chin. You got a point there, Fred. I guess I should take into account how people get these things, see? Well, so he changed his plans. He said, you can use wooden beams, and he used railroad ties, actually. Actually, you can't get them cheap. You get railroad ties, you know, for landscape purposes. You pay through on those right now anyhow, but that's... there was a time when you could almost get them for hauling them off, see? And at that time, probably they weren't too expensive. So he built his air raid shelter, and he used railroad ties across to provide holding up a pile of dirt above, and you can crawl in there and so on. Well, I think his series of articles was just starting, and they had a brush fire. That brush fire burned all the brush on that hillside, and it burned the railroad ties, and the roof caved in. I never had the heart to speak to Bill Libby again about that, but he stopped his series. And I killed his series by asking him this question: where are you going to get those beams? Well, it was a perfectly good question. I mean, I wasn't trying to be nasty. I thought I was helping him. And that cooled off his syndicated articles on how to build your own air raid shelter for sweat of the brow and minimal equipment. And he took a lot of ribbing, but he never said a word to me. For all I know, maybe he forgot. Maybe he thought that it was his own idea to... I shouldn't say that. That's nasty. But he never called me to task. Well, how could he? I mean, call me to task for steering him on that track. Bill Libby and I were pretty good friends. We didn't see a lot of each other, to be sure. But Bill was very conservative in his attitude. Would be a darling of people, disposition of Ronald Reagan and that sort, quite. And I was not of that same bent. But Bill wanted to be president of the University of California. One time I was in New York. Clara was with me then. We had dinner with Gordon Ray when he was head of the Guggenheim Foundation. And Bill Libby was a guest too. Bill was on his board for recommending people and so on. And that night, Bill was downright drunk. And he had too much. And we got to talking about university and so on. And then all of a sudden he turned to me. Says, Fred, where were you when they were picking a new president of the University of California? Why weren't you speaking up for me? Out of the blue. Gordon Ray apologized the next day to us for what Bill said. He thought it was disgraceful, and then, my God, it just came out of the blue. Look, I hate to say this. I'm just telling you the truth as I recall him, because Bill and I were friends, see, but... But then one time, say, I got to go get, you know, I'm having trouble with my urinary tract fluids about Bill, because there was one interesting offshoot which relates to the my experience here at La Jolla, at the university here. It was the last year I was here. The university was talking about the business of how they dealt with retirees, people who had reached what was then considered the normal retirement age. You know, there was talk about extending it and so on. But it was felt that it would be a good idea to, on an individual basis, to extend the appointments if it was felt that the individual could make a useful contribution. And the trouble with that was that if you say it's possible to extend it, people begin to then say, well, it's my right. You know, you always invariably run into that. Whenever there's a judgment factor, who's going to say, but in our judgment, you're not the guy who ought to have his appointment extended. All right. Along about that time, there was a political theorist. darn it, I'm trying to remember. You know, I have difficulty with names again. Anyhow, there was this fellow who... See, I'll ask my wife. I want to give you a name in just a moment.
Sure.
Yeah. His name was Herbert Marcuse, now I remember. Herbert Marcuse was a darling of the left. And he had an appointment here, and there was a question of whether his appointment should be renewed. I had talked to Herbert Marcuse a couple of times, and although the students seemed to love him, especially the students who were inclined to go in for demonstrations and so on, he was their hero. If you were inclined to protest and so on, he would champion their cause. And but when I talked to them once about the nature of the students with whom he worked, you know, the graduate level, there were no students around and so on. He says, you know, they're a pretty lousy bunch, or worse to that effect. So it's funny. He was their champion, but he didn't think a hell of a lot of the students. Well, but at any rate, that's an aside. The point is that the question of his reappointment came up. At the same time, the question of Pauling's reappointment at UCSD was coming up. And various people were asked for comments and so on. And I looked at the the credentials. I was familiar with Pauling's, and I looked at what Marcuse had been doing. And I made the recommendation, in essence, that Marcuse hadn't been doing any particular scholarly work for a number of years. And under the circumstances, I really didn't think an exception should be made for him. In the case of Pauling, he's still working, same person who's doing research. That'd be a different matter. So I split on the two. Interestingly enough, the fact that I had said that Marcuse probably ought not to be reappointed got to then Governor Reagan's attention, and he was pleased. And I didn't know that at the time, but subsequently, Bill Libby, and this is why I reminded. Bill Libby told about possible future for me and things. He says, you know, Fred, the governor thinks well of you. And I wonder if the governor thinks well of me. Why the hell should he think well of me? I mean, the only thing that occurred to me was this business about not recommending Marcuse for continued employment. Well, it had nothing to do with the politics of it. Absolutely nothing. It's just that the guy hadn't been doing anything except getting students to demonstrate, and I think that's hardly a reason for having a person on campus. I mean, I never voted for Reagan. I didn't share his thoughts, political thoughts, but that doesn't mean I have to swallow hook, line, and sinker somebody who is just stirring up things. And so Bill Libby told me how I was in good graces with the governor, and well, so that's a little thing about Bill Libby, but the other story I told you can get more stories about Bill Libby from other people, because I was not close to him, see. But I do remember that one thing about the air raid shelter, and that I can testify to. Then, Harold Urey.
Yes, he was going to ask you.
Yeah. We were quite close to the Urys. Now, Clara and Frieda Urey were very good friends, very close friends indeed, and we would share meals together and things like that. And this has persisted through the years, even after Harold became rather incapable of moving much. The one place he would come to was to our house here, and he died then some years ago, and Frieda is still alive, but she's 93 or 94, something like that. Much more frail than used to be, of course. A remarkable woman, but Clara sees her periodically, and
could keep in touch. So Harold Urey was a pretty tough-nosed scientist in his early days. He softened up more in his later years, and he was I'd say very understanding about things in general, and he was a defender of the right to express thoughts, whether he shared them or not. He really was a libertarian in the sense that he felt that you've got a right to speak, and the audience should be orderly and not shout anybody down by catcalls. Well, Harold, I remember once when he came to the University of Illinois, I was still on the faculty, probably before I was dean. He gave a lecture on the moon. He got into geology and the moon business rather early, almost immediately after the war. And he was introduced by Worth Rodebush, who liked to play little jokes on people at times, before he gave the lecture. And Rodebush said, Professor Urey, of course, has distinguished himself in a way, has discovered deuterium. He's never had an element named after him, however. Probably won't until he discovers the halogen. And, Urey remembered that because years later, when we were here, I said to Harold, I remember when you gave a lecture at Illinois. And we talked about various things. He said, that lecture, oh, I remember. That's when Worth Rodebush said something about my needing to discover a halogen. And that stuck in his mind, and I had forgotten about it until he reminded me of it.
That's interesting.
So,
where did you first meet him, here, or...
I think the first time I met Harold Urey was at an ACS meeting where we happened to be at the same table eating, but that was all. And I had applied for a postdoctoral position with Harold. Now I remember with Harold Urey when he was at Columbia, when I was nearing the end of my graduate work. At the same time I had applied at Illinois and so on. When I got the Illinois job, I don't know what would have happened with regard to my application to Harold. He had expressed an interest in some of the thoughts I had. I had to write up some things that I was thinking about. And I was neither offered nor rejected a job. It just didn't reach any particular point like that. I was glad, of course, to go to Illinois and have what was presumably a ongoing job. I met Harold the first time, I think, at an ACS meeting, and then I met him at Illinois when he gave that lecture. And now I begin to wonder. Of course, we got to know him even better here. Here's where we really got to know him. And our connections here were principally social. They weren't scientific. But we saw a lot of each other on a purely social basis.